The headlines this hour. Iran begins a major military exercise in the Persian Gulf region as it warns against any attack on its military and nuclear sites. Russia warns of a possible military response if NATO fails to ease its security concerns as the Western military alliance expands its presence in Eastern Europe. Also in the headlines, monsoon-triggered floods leave a trail of death and destruction in Malaysia, forcing thousands of people to flee their homes on the country's east coast. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launches large-scale military drills in the south of the country, involving a variety of units. The maneuvers are codenamed the Great Prophet 17. They are held in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz regions, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The IRGC Deputy Commander for Operations says the ground, naval, and aerospace divisions, as well as some popular forces, participate in the exercises. Abbas Neil Furushan says the theme of the drills is might, security, and active deterrence under the auspices of national unity, solidarity, and unanimity. Says the objective of the drills is to increase the combat readiness of IRGC forces by using the most advanced equipment and tactics to counter enemy threats and combined arms warfare. Meanwhile, a senior Iranian military commander has warned of a crushing response to any attack on the Islamic Republic's military and nuclear facilities. During our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
A top Iranian military commander is warning that the Islamic Republic will give a crushing response to any attack on its military and nuclear sites. The commander of the Khatam al-Anbiya Central Headquarters has warned that Iran will not hesitate in its response. Major General Ghulam Ali Rashid says Iran will target the source of aggression, the base, the territory, and the airspace used for any possible attack. He said that any Israeli threat against Iranian sites will be impossible without the U.S. support. Back in September, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs said that the regime is preparing a strike on Iran. American and other Israeli officials have made similar suggestions over the past months. All right, now let me invite two guests and ask their opinion about this. So John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining me from Basel, Switzerland. Also, we have Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who's joining us out of London. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let me turn to John and Basel. John, as you just heard in the intro, Iran is also at the same time conducting some military drills, and they are annual and they are regularly actually held. But on the other hand, we have the Israeli officials every now and then, almost maybe once or twice every month recently, they are making open threats against Iran. They are saying that they have allocated a certain budget and they're doing this and doing that, and the military option is on the table against Iran. And also we have the U.S. also doing the same thing. So what's your assessment of the situation?
Well, unfortunately, the virus of uniqueness that the United States claims has spread to Israel, and they now behave as if they were also above the law, and that international law and the ban on aggressive actions against other countries don't even exist. This kind of what they call exceptionalism in the United States simply can't be accepted around the world. And this is the way that wars start. So the threats from Israel are clearly contrary to the spirit and the letter of international law. And Iran needs to take these matters up at all international bodies and to seek foreign partners to deter military action by the United States or Israel or together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Mohsen Abbas, how do you look at this? And the Iranian commander was also stressing that any possible attack by Israel will not be possible without the backing of the U.S.
Well, nothing Israel does is without the blessings of the U.S. Often it's confusing as to who's leading and who's actually following, but they seem to be a tag team, and the reality is that their interests seem to align in West Asia, and imperialism and control and, if you like, plunder seem to be the main priority for Israel. Of course, it's also now a question of survival, they would argue. The bottom line is that they've oppressed Palestinians. They've robbed them of their lands. They've disrespected international law on every level. They continue to expand what they termed Palestinian territories by putting up all these settlements. And to boot, what Israel understands is that the only player in the West Asia which has any capability, inclination, or ability to challenge them is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Therefore, everything they do is geared towards, in one way or another, destroying the Islamic Republic, whilst maintaining their own, as my colleague said, exceptionalism in terms of no scrutiny of their nuclear weapons threat to the region, no scrutiny of their Yinon plan of expansion, zero scrutiny of their psyops in every nation around, which doesn't comply with their diktat, including Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and even Iran. Their black operations go on in all of these countries. The violation of the sovereignty of Syria is a daily practice through their military, aerial attacks. So actually, there's nothing reigning in Israel. They've been given free license by the Americans. They're armed by the Americans, essentially. Now the Israelis have developed their own defense industry. And of course, they're a rogue state. And the Americans themselves are a rogue state who don't accept international law on any level. Iran, of course, is standing strong, standing tall, and it's not willing to back down. The Israelis are now in America, the top administration is there, trying to push not only the destruction of the JCPOA agreement, the nuclear treaty that was signed with Iran by the major powers, but also they want them to get rid of their ballistic missiles. Which sane nation would, with the threat of Israel and its nuclear armed to the teeth military, want to give up ballistic missiles, and let alone, of course, this kind of notion of these phantom nuclear abilities that Iran has, which it clearly doesn't. The fact is, Israel wants war. It can't do it straight away because Iran is well equipped to counter their threat. So what they're resorting to is trying to get America involved to do its dirty work for them. And so far, the Americans aren't biting totally. Who knows how long that resistance will continue.
Okay, thanks for your comment. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst in Basel. Seth Mosen Abbas, journalist and political commentator in London.
Welcome back. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has held his weekly presser, with the ongoing negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries in Vienna being the focal point of the event.
The image we have from the JCPOA is a contradictory one. Some people say they are optimistic and there's been progress in talks, but at the same time, some Europeans say there is only a few weeks left, and they're giving an ultimatum to Iran, and they're worried about Iran's nuclear advances. They say the JCPOA has turned into an empty shell. Can you give us a clear image about the talks and the future of negotiations in Vienna, please? Thank you.
Well, basically, the two sides have to avoid warning comments. The words that are alarming do not have depth. I have already clearly announced, and now once again announced, that the Troika has to know that the JCPOA became void for Iran at a time when the U.S. withdrew from the deal and imposed unilateral sanctions against the Iranian nation, and the three European countries moved in line with the U.S. by not taking any action. I urge the other side to focus on negotiations in Vienna. Iran is neither optimistic nor pessimistic. Tehran is optimistic about the principle of negotiations, and the other side has to be optimistic about the principle of talks, too.
Khatibzadeh said that Tehran is very realistic about the path that it is taking, and that is why the Islamic Republic is taking measures to remove U.S. sanctions in the course of the negotiations. The spokesman noted that Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have come up with two new draft documents, which are the results of intense negotiations in Vienna. He said the documents are the basis of future negotiations. Khatibzadeh said the draft documents could have been agreed upon much sooner if the other side followed the same approach that it did during the last days of the talks in Vienna. Tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine drag on. Moscow has warned of a possible military response if NATO fails to come up with a political action to ease its security concerns. The warning comes from Konstantin Gavrilov, head of the Russian delegations to negotiations on military security and arms control in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Gavrilov has also accused the Western military alliance of hitting what he called Russia's sore spots. Last week, Moscow released a list of security proposals that it would like the U.S. and NATO to provide. This includes a promise the alliance would give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine. The West claims Russia may be preparing an invasion of its ex-Soviet neighbor. Moscow has denied the claim. It instead blames Kiev and its Western allies for creating tensions near Russian borders. Chileans take to the streets in the capital, Santiago, to celebrate the victory of leftist candidate Gabriel Boric in the country's presidential runoff. Streets in other Chilean cities also erupted in celebration. Boric garnered 56% of the votes, with almost 99% of the ballots counted. His rival, far-right José Antonio Kast, secured 44%. Several Latin American presidents have sent congratulatory messages to Boric. He will take office for a four-year term, starting from March of next year. The new president will be dealing with some of Chile's big challenges, including high inflation, the COVID pandemic, and social unrest. He will also be in power for the approval of a new constitution that is in the process of drafting. At least 8 people are killed as monsoon-triggered floods ravaged the eastern coast of Malaysia. All fatalities have been reported from Selangor, the country's wealthiest and most populous region. Authorities say about 55,000 people have also been evacuated since Friday. Floods have caused many rivers to overflow, submerging both urban and rural regions and leaving vehicles stranded. 8 states have been affected, with Pahang being the hardest hit. Thousands of personnel from the army and other security agencies have been mobilized for rescue and rehabilitation efforts. But the government is facing criticism from the public and opposition lawmakers over its rescue efforts. Stormy monsoon seasons at the end of the year often bring deaths and devastation to Malaysia. The death toll from a devastating typhoon that swept across the Philippines has climbed to 375, making it one of the deadliest storms to strike the Southeast Asian country. According to police, at least 500 people have been injured, and dozens are still unaccounted for. There are fears that more people may have died due to widespread landslides and flooding. Meanwhile, the military has been ordered to send its airplanes and naval vessels to deliver aid to the affected areas. Super Typhoon Rai is the strongest to have hit the Philippines this year. It made landfall on Thursday, ravaging the country's southern and central regions. The storm has knocked out power and communication links in many areas. Over 380,000 people have been forced to flee their homes. More casualties in Sudan as crackdown on anti-coup protests continues. A Sudanese medical group has confirmed the death of one protester during a rally in the capital, Khartoum. An independent doctors' committee says the man died after being shot with a bullet in the chest. The health ministry says 123 protesters were also injured. There were also protests in several other cities. Sunday's rallies were among the largest since the military takeover, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan on October 25th. People continued to hit the streets despite the reinstatement of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was ousted in the coup. At least 46 people have been killed and scores wounded since then. The protesters want a full civilian rule. They are also against a recent deal between the military and Hamdok, as well as a military-dominated transitional government. New documents obtained by a leading U.S. daily reveal how the Pentagon has drastically undercounted civilian deaths from its airstrikes in 3 Muslim countries. Not only that, but also no one in the U.S. military has been punished for the deeply flawed air campaign in West Asia. This report takes a closer look at how an in-depth review of hundreds of secret files has blown the lid off a massive cover-up in the U.S. military.
An investigation into the confidential documents of the U.S. military has laid bare horrifying facts about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed more than 1,300 records drawn from a hidden Pentagon archive, and all that has shed more light on how U.S. airstrikes have resulted in thousands of civilian deaths in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but have gone mostly underreported. Based on the U.S. military's own count, air raids have killed some 1,600 civilians in these countries over the past years. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. A particular case that's been highlighted is a 2016 attack on a hamlet in northern Syria that the U.S. military said killed 85 Daesh terrorists. But as it turned out later, the victims were in fact 120 farmers and villagers. The high number of civilian deaths also hints at the deeply flawed intelligence plaguing the U.S. bombing campaign, as well as the hasty and imprecise targeting that is in sharp contrast to precision bombs and eagle-eyed drones propagated by the U.S. military. It also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. A more recent example is the U.S. drone strike that took the lives of 10 members of an Afghan family, 7 of them children, in Kabul back in August. The Pentagon initially claimed that terrorists had been killed. Then it was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. The New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation. Despite such a terrible record, the U.S. keeps up with its air campaigns mostly in Muslim nations. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army officer, believes it is time the international community moved to stop the U.S. war machine from spilling more innocent blood.
When is the world going to stand up and stop allowing the U.S. to call every other nation a state sponsor of terrorism and say that the United States is indeed the state sponsor of terrorism globally because it is engaged in the destruction of the world? When is the world going to stand up and tell the truth?
The U.S. Army carried out more than 50,000 airstrikes in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan between 2014 and 2019. The aim was allegedly to eliminate militants and terrorists and bring peace and stability to those countries. But those bombardments brought nothing other than death and destruction, and the U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
I am now in south of Iran, in the beautiful province of Hormozgan. This province is usually known by its important strategic ports like Bandar Lenge, Bandar Abbas, or the beautiful islands of Kish, Kesh, Bu Musa, the Greater Tomb and the Lesser Tomb, as well as Hengam. However, you might get surprised to hear that Hormozgan is one of the mountainous regions of southern Iran, which is home to unique, amazing heights. Today, I'm going to take you to Shotariku Canyon. Stay with me. Hormozgan province is the eighth vast province of Iran. This vast province is located in the proximity of the Persian Gulf and north of the Strait of Hormuz. Shotariku Canyon is one of the spectacular natural places of this province. This canyon is located in a village called Chakchak. Shotariku in English means dark night, and that's because of the fact that in order to enter this canyon, you have to pass through a dark cave. The mountains of Shotariku, like most of the mountains of southern Iran, have different amazing appearances. These mountains have light-colored coarse appearance with several dents caused by hard erosion of these heights. The coarse shape of these heights seems to be horrible at the first glance. In the middle of these heights, there is a coarse rocky canyon, which has a seasonal river flowing through it. However, sometimes because of lack of precipitation and high temperature, no river exists. In order to hike this coarse, punishing canyon, you have to pass over several rocks. So, you'd better be accompanied by a tour guide. I am now in Chakchak village. My backpack is ready and I have filled my flask with cool fresh water. A kind local woman of this village just gave me some fresh date, which I have put it in my backpack. I'm totally prepared to have a tour to Shotariku Canyon. To be honest, I'm very excited. How much distance I've covered to this point. I have to take a rest. I'm really thirsty. Okay, now. Oh, it's so beautiful here. On my both sides, there are tall mountains, each side of them with a different color. Oh, very beautiful. I've reached a two-way road. The right path ends in Shotariku and
The left path ends in Odabe, which is a more twisting way. I choose the right path. Oh my god, here is full of green bushes. It's interesting to note that most of the plants in this region have medicinal effects. Oh, what a pity. I don't have any knowledge about these herbs. Oh, the shape of the rocks here is very strange, and they're filled with moss. So I have to be more careful to walk, otherwise I will slip over them. I am now inside the canyon. The weather is cool. There are different birds in here, which their singing can be heard in every corner of the canyon. They sing beautifully. Oh my god, it's gorgeous. Ah, there are some pits in here which have green or azure colored water. The reflection on the walls of the rocks is astonishing. Oh, the movement of the water and the calm in here have made this atmosphere very mysterious, as if I'm in a dream. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
The topic, this Fatimiya, has been having a connection, an emotional connection with Fatimatu Zahra, salamullahi alayha. We said that we want to talk about the emotional connection and relationship with Fatimatu Zahra, salamullahi alayha. This is important for us. One of the points that was mentioned, and I think I'll highlight this one, this was, I think I can say, most important. And we started off by saying that ulama that are at a higher rank in terms of their spiritual development, as far as we have seen, obviously this is my experience, my judgment that I'm giving you. Allama Hasanzada Amuli, this great man who is known more for his works in theoretical irfan, these people that You have heard, when we look at them and what they say regarding Fatimatu Zahra, their connection, their emotional connection with Fatimatu Zahra, salamullah alayha, is greater. And then when we look at the shuhada, Hajj Qasim, may Allah bless his soul, this great shaheed, whenever he mentioned Fatimatu Zahra, salamullah alayha, the tawassulat, military, obviously and very evidently, much further ahead of us in their spiritual journey and wayfaring towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When they're like this, then that means there's something very special. We've got to start developing that. Then, the sir of Laylatul Qadr in Surah Al-Qadr, إنا أنزلناه في ليلة القدر وما أدراك ما ليلة القدر. ليلة القدر, according to the hadith, which is the platform, for want of a better word, it's where and when and the context of which تنزل الملائكة والروح, the malaika and the ruh descend to the earth to Khalifatullah. That all happens in the context of Laylatul Qadr. Laylatul Qadr, which allows for all of this to happen, according to hadith, is Fatimatu Zahra, salamullahi alayha. This shouldn't be seen as something, oh, we feel good. Please, let's get past emotional conversations. This is very real. This is very real. This means that she is, if Laylatul Qadr involves our destiny, Laylatul Qadr involves what will happen, then Fatimatu Zahra is involved with everything that happens to us. She's present and she's involved. She's involved according to that. That leads us to the second one. We said there's three elements of the way we need to look at our conversations with Fatimatu Zahra. One is that she's present. That's proven. Also, moving on, she's involved. She's involved and she has the ability, she has the power. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given her the power. The fate of every single person on earth, according to those ahadith, this is a small glimpse of her ability. All of that being brought down to the earth and being, in a sense, signed by the Waliullah based on what God wants. All of this happens in the context of Fatimatu Zahra, salamullahi alayha. So the fate of everyone she is involved with, and she is the one that makes that fate be able to be brought down and be able to be signed and be able to be sent back and to be able for it to be implemented. This is ability. She is capable. If we combine all of these points, this understanding, and then compare to a conversation with Fatimatu Zahra that doesn't have these elements, one is not convinced of them, and where one is convinced of them from our perspective, because the reality is the evidence that I briefly presented, there's overwhelming evidence of this. It's basic, very brief explanations of it. That's the reality. That's the truth of the matter. This is who she is. For us, if I have that understanding, if I have that belief, or if I don't have that belief, if I speak to Fatimatu Zahra as a thought, concept, just imaginary thing, the way non-Muslims, non-theists speak to, I don't know, something of power in their minds, whatever it is, which is even not real, it's not even real. Some superstitious thing. That's one way of having that conversation. Another way of having that conversation is to see her present. So now that you see her present, if you're speaking to a person that's actually there, what will you mention to a person that's there that's not involved in your life? There's some friend of yours, some acquaintance of yours, some random person on the street that you decide to have a conversation with and you have your chest full. What you will say to them when you don't think they're involved in your life, you're just getting something off your chest. You're not really saying anything for any benefit of yours. You just want to say it, and now there's an opportunity. You said it. What are you going to say? How are you going to say it? How will you have that conversation? That's one way. It is speaking. It is getting something off the chest. But when you speak to someone that is involved with your situation, a conversation is not going to last 2 minutes. Conversation isn't going to just be getting something off the chest. It's a real conversation. It's real talk. I'm trying to get my thoughts straight to speak and say the right things and expect a response. And then when I have this conversation with someone who is involved, they're involved, they know what's going on, they're involved in what we're doing, maybe we're doing it together, they need to do part of it. But if you don't see them as capable in helping your situation, although they're involved, you won't be too inclined to talk to them about your conditions and to try to ask help from them. You just naturally won't, because you don't have the thought process that they can do anything. If you talk to them, maybe a little more than someone that is not involved. They are involved, they're present, you're talking to them, but they're not really capable of doing anything. Or if you're not sure if they're capable, you think maybe they're capable. That's one type of conversation. You speak to that person one way. And when you're sure that they are fully capable of helping you in that situation, they are present, you're not trying to call on them, not knowing, are they hearing, are they not hearing? Are they listening, are they not? Is this message going to get across or not? No, she's present. She hears. She's involved in my life. And she can help me in the conditions. Then the conversation is going to be very different.
أسعفيني بفيضك المعطاء
إنه سلمي إلى العلياء فامنحي نفحة الحياة يا سبيلي إلى النجاة يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء يا طريقا إلى العلا
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
فاطم الزهراء.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The International Criminal Court's decision to deprioritize a probe into crimes by the U.S. and its allies came after years of U.S. obstruction. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alice Sperry, writer. This article is published under the heading, How U.S. Derailed an Effort to Prosecute Its Crimes in Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. The new chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, the only international body with the authority to prosecute individuals over genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, has recently sought to reopen a previously suspended investigation in Afghanistan, but with a caveat. The probe would not include conduct by the United States and its allies, all of which have committed crimes that fall squarely with the court's jurisdiction. The court's prosecutor, Karim Khan, who has been on the job for just over 3 months, wrote in a statement that his office would focus exclusively on crimes committed by Taliban and Daesh. A preliminary investigation of crimes committed in Afghanistan since that country joined the court in 2003 had been underway for more than a decade, before a full investigation was authorized and then suspended in favor of an Afghanistan-led process. That investigation included crimes committed by all parties to the conflict, marking the first time the ICC probed crimes committed by U.S. forces, which in Afghanistan include extrajudicial killings, drone strikes that killed an untold number of civilians, and torture. Now, if a panel of ICC judges authorized the prosecutor's request, the resumed investigation would deprioritize other aspects of this investigation, Khan said, an implicit reference to the U.S. and its allies. The announcement dealt a blow to victims, human rights advocates, and those who had placed in the ICC their last hope to see the crimes committed by U.S. personnel and officials prosecuted in a court of law. While many Afghans welcomed the reopening of a case that they hope will preserve the international community's scrutiny of the newly installed Taliban government, they warned that the decision would threaten the credibility of a court that has long faced questions about its ability to take on the world's most powerful countries. The ICC has historically operated with limited resources, with an annual budget of roughly $172 million paid by its 123 members. In a world starved for justice and accountability, the ICC's resource problem has at times become a political one, raising questions about how the court prioritizes which cases to tackle. In recent years, the ICC has opened inquiries into potential crimes and Israeli regime crimes in Palestine, and it has opened and then shuttered preliminary inquiries into acts committed by British troops in Iraq. All have faced significant opposition. The U.S., which is not an ICC member, has also long taken a hostile stance toward the court, opposing investigations into its allies, including the Zionist regime, and fiercely contesting the court's jurisdiction over U.S. nationals. U.S. officials have put extensive pressure on the court, the Afghan government, and U.S. allies in an effort to derail any investigation of American crimes. Under ICC rules, the court can open an investigation if a member country requests it, if the United Nations Security Council refers the case, or if it believes that one of the crimes that fall under its jurisdiction were committed within the territory of a member state or by nationals of a member state operating in another country. It was under that third category that the court claimed authority over the conduct of U.S. nationals in Afghanistan, as well as in Romania, Lithuania, and Poland, where the CIA operated black sites. The prosecutors had opened to find a receptive partner in the administration of President Barack Obama, particularly as the American public had widely condemned the war on terror tactics of his predecessor. But U.S. officials unequivocally warned the court that the opposition to the investigation of American crimes was bipartisan. With political opposition from the strongest party to the conflict, their preliminary inquiry in Afghanistan dragged along for a decade. In 2017, with President Donald Trump newly in office, Ben Suda finally moved to formally request the court's permission to launch an official investigation. In 2019, the ICC's pretrial chamber, the body tasked with authorizing a formal investigation, denied such authorization, an unprecedented decision that cited, among other things, the political climate surrounding the probe. Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, had been fiercely opposed to the ICC since his days in Bush administration, and he encouraged Trump to threaten ICC officials with sanctions and prosecution, as well as to revoke Bensouda's entry visa to the U.S. The prosecutor's team denounced the scare tactics and pressed forward, projecting, outwardly at least, a continuing willingness to take on the U.S. The court's investigation of U.S. acts had barely started, however, and political pressure on the ICC was threatening to thwart other aspects of the probe as well. ICC prosecutors and representatives of victims successfully appealed the denial from pre-trial chambers, and the ICC's appeals chambers authorized a formal investigation in Afghanistan on March 5th, 2020. In response, the Trump administration issued an executive order condemning the ICC and imposed sanctions on Bensouda and Mocho Choco, the first time the U.S. had ever taken such action against officials of an international body. Critics of the decision argued that deprioritizing U.S. and other foreign powers' crimes undermines the court's principle of impartiality and reveals a lack of understanding of the conditions that precipitated the collapse of the Afghan government in the first place. Lee Evenstone, an associate director of HRW's International Justice Program who focuses on the ICC, noted that Khan's decision, one of his first official actions, reignites long-standing questions about how the court chooses to allocate its limited resources. The work that the ICC does has to be meaningful, she said. For it to be meaningful, it needs to resonate and relate to victims' experiences. It needs to be perceived as independent. It needs to be perceived as impartial. Before it was shelved, the ICC investigation into U.S. crimes in Afghanistan was expected to focus primarily on the torture program, which was much better documented than drone strikes and other crimes. Those would also fall under the ICC's jurisdiction, but it's unclear how closely the court was investigating them. Critics of the decision to scale back the probe have noted that by essentially enabling impunity for U.S. crimes, the court risks sending the message to dictators, autocrats, and even other powerful democracies that they may get away with them too. Even as the ICC's effort to reopen part of its Afghanistan investigation could lead to justice for some victims of Taliban and Daesh, it is leaving countless others behind. It is also denying Americans an opportunity to see their own government held accountable for the crimes it committed in their name. While a series of public inquiries have shed light on many of the abuses of the U.S. has carried out during its two-decade so-called war on terror, there have been no significant criminal or civil cases against those responsible. This is as much about the U.S. as it is about Afghanistan. It's about Afghan victims, but it's also about the U.S. military and its deep and systematic problems. Americans who care about the U.S. should care about this issue.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Ilam commemoration ceremony.
فشار دشمن و فشار جنگ نتوانسته از بروز استعدادهای این مردم چیزی کم کنه. خیلی مهم.
The pressures brought by the enemy and the war could not stop the people of this province from showing their talents. This is very important. People like the dear martyr, Martyr Rezai Nejad, have a high spiritual status as well as a scientific status. The reason for their high spiritual status is the fact that they were martyred, because martyrdom is not achieved easily. Martyrdom
and obtaining this rank requires the existence of certain prerequisites in the nature and actions of individuals. Without these prerequisites, martyrdom is not granted to anyone. That young scientist possessed that high spiritual status, and that was why he was martyred. Otherwise, one will not become a martyr without these qualities.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
یک نکته مهم این است که خب گفته میشه که 3000 اندی شهید استان ایلام تقدیم کرده و استانهای دیگه هم هر کدوم به فراخور جمعیت و وضعیت خودشون شهدای زیادی رو تقدیم کردند. مفهوم شهادت رو بایستی ما درست درک کنیم.
An important point is that the province of Ilam has given over 3,000 martyrs. Other provinces too have each given many martyrs in proportion with their population and their situation. We should understand the concept of martyrdom correctly, because martyrdom does not mean merely being a victim of the war. Well, there are many people who participate in wars and who are killed in their country's wars. Many of them are killed in defending the geographical borders of their country and remembered as patriots and heroes. Of course, some are mercenaries, but the rest are remembered, as I've said. However, our martyrs are not like this. Those of our soldiers who were martyred or disabled were not just trying to defend the geographical borders of the country. They were also struggling to defend the borders of belief, morality, religion, culture, and the spiritual borders. Of course, defending the borders of the country is a valuable act in and of itself. This has value, but it is not as important as both fighting for those important concepts and defending the borders of the country. Our martyrs are like this. If we want to look at this at a higher level, our martyrs are, in fact, the manifestation of this verse. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.